This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 6, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Pentagon releases the names of hundreds of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay who have yet to know the accusations against them. And FSRN speaks with Afghani Member of Parliament Malalai Joya about the warlords still ruling the country.
Because I'm young, till I have energy, I will try to serve my people. And in another hand, I try to expose the enemies of Afghanistan.
All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Today, the Army Corps of Engineers resumed demolition of 120 severely damaged homes in New Orleans, the vast majority in the city's Lower Ninth Ward. Christian Roseland has more.
A small bulldozer tore apart a structure sitting in the middle of Winthrop Street in the city's Lower Ninth Ward today, the first of the homes scheduled for demolition this week. The crew was accompanied by cadaver-sniffing dogs, as remains continue to be found in the area. John Fogarty of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
What we're looking at now is starting to move into some areas north of Claiborne where structures have floated into the right-of-way. We need to get those cleared so that that continuing effort of restoring those utilities, those water lines, those utility lines, for either gas, power. We need to get those structures out the way so those utility companies can come in there and restore those.
The Lower Ninth Ward still does not have potable water and few homes have electric service. The City of New Orleans says that it has mailed out demolition notices to the last known addresses of homeowners. Michelle Shin of the aid organization Common Ground, which opposed the bulldozing in December, said her organization has not been in contact with any residents who were to receive said notification. The City of New Orleans has not said when it will resume demolition of the other 1,800 homes that it plans to remove. For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
The South Central farmers at the nation's largest urban garden are facing eviction tomorrow at midnight by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. KPFK's Kelly Barnes reports.
Last night, a community strategy meeting was followed by a candlelight vigil to help keep the farm in the hands of the 350 low-income families that work the 14 acres. Despite the fact the farmers have raised $9 million to buy the garden, developer Ralph Horowitz is demanding $16.35 million, even though he paid just over $5 million to buy it back from the city in 2003. Farmers say that sale was a backroom deal, and they're not willing to consider a compromise offered by the mayor's office of accepting 4 or 5 acres at the current location and a few smaller plots throughout the city. So far, the mayor has not responded to farmers' demands of a citywide town hall meeting on the issue, in particular on the legality of the transfer of land back to Horowitz after the city took it under eminent domain. Tonight, the community is expected to turn out in force in support of the farmers, a continuation of the 24-hour presence at the farm for the last several months. In L.A. for FSRN, I'm Kelly Barnes for People Without Borders.
In a unanimous decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that military recruiters must be allowed onto the campuses of any college or university that receives federal funding. This knocks down a legal challenge raised by some law schools that question the nature of the don't ask, don't tell policy that recruiters practice. Universities receive some $35 billion a year in federal funding. The Hamas-dominated Palestinian parliament's first legislative session ended today with the walkout of Fatah Party legislators. They were opposing a move to challenge powers that were granted to President Abbas in the final days of the previous parliament. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has announced plans to evacuate additional West Bank settlements and defined Israel's permanent borders if the Kadima Party of the acting prime minister wins national elections later this month. Manar Jabrin has the story.
Acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced yesterday that 17 settlement outposts will be cleared in the first stage of a four-year withdrawal plan. The evacuated settlers of these outposts will be relocated to major settlement blocks. Unlike last year's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, Israel is not planning a military disengagement from the evacuated West Bank land. Mr. Olmert has indicated that Israel will hold on to the Jordan Valley as well as East Jerusalem and the major settlement blocks of Ma'ali Adumim, Ariel, and Gosh Atzion as part of a final settlement. The move would cement Israeli control over the most heavily populated settlements in the West Bank, where Israel is building a controversial separation wall. All settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are illegal under international law. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Over 500 migrant workers took to the streets of Hong Kong yesterday to call on the government to increase the minimum wage that was lowered in 2003. Dante Tosa has more.
Hundreds of migrant workers helped sign saying, "Stop modern slavery, wage increase now." These domestic workers are employed in private homes throughout Hong Kong. In 2003, the minimum wage was lowered from $470 to $428 US dollars a month. With the government announcement in the new year that Hong Kong is no longer in a financial crisis, the workers are demanding that the elimination of a $50 tax levied against migrant domestic workers and a return to the pre-2003 minimum wage of $470. There are over 200,000 migrant workers in Hong Kong, many of them from the Philippines, Indonesia, and Thailand. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dante Tosa reporting from Hong Kong.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
NATO has once again signaled that it will be the dominating force in Afghanistan before the end of the year. The United States has remained in the background, though, saying their troop levels will decrease by less than 20%. As Leanne Caldwell reports from D.C., some policy experts say the move will relieve some troop strain for other U.S.-led missions.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization will increase troop levels from 9,000 to 21,000 troops before the end of the year, and they will also expand to all parts of Afghanistan, even those in which the fighting tends to be most common.
Which means that by the end of the year, that Afghanistan could be a NATO mission. As a matter of fact, I think Afghanistan will be a NATO mission.
General James L. Jones is head of European NATO Command. The general says the toughest challenge NATO will have is gaining control of the narcotics production in that country. He also said that warlords have a stake in every aspect of life there. NATO will attempt peacekeeping and nation-building efforts.
And I'm particularly pleased by the will that nations have shown to do more in Afghanistan in particular, because that's a challenging mission.
A transfer of NATO precludes the idea that the United States will reduce their troop levels, but the U.S. has been vague. They announced in December they will reduce their troop levels by 3,000 ahead of the NATO transfer, but have given few details. They have declined to say how many troops will be under NATO head and which will continue what they call the offensive, the fighting of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in that country. General Jones revealed a bit more detail on the U.S.'s role.
The U.S.-led coalition that wants to continue the counter-terrorist mission, that is the offensive, military mission, will do so, continue to do so under a special arrangement under the U.S. Central Command, while the rest of the nations of ISAF will continue to do their, for all intents and purposes, it'll be one headquarters. It will have a unity of effort, and we'll just have that slight little difference about the military forces and how they're used.
James Dobbins, Director of International Security and Defense Policy at the conservative RAND Corporation, he says the complete transfer to NATO is long overdue.
It's been discussed at NATO headquarters for more than a year. It has been planned and agreed at least for the last several months. So it is going forward along a pretty much pre-agreed schedule.
26 NATO countries will have troops in Afghanistan, and 10 non-NATO countries will also provide assistance. John Pike with GlobalSecurity.org, a group of security experts that hope to reduce war, said this decision for NATO to move into the dangerous southeastern Afghanistan is because of heavy persuasion from the United States.
The European attitude towards Afghanistan operations is basically much more positive than it is towards the Iraqi adventure. And I think that the U.S. government has been of the view that if Europe supports pacification of Afghanistan, they should do so with troops and free up American troops to go over to Iraq and other troubled spots.
NATO will not only expand in Afghanistan, it will expand its missions in northern Africa and along the West African coast. General Jones said NATO will take a more proactive stance to global security. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf is accusing Afghanistan's defense ministry and intelligence of conspiring against his country. His comments come in response to Afghanistan's recent accusation that Pakistan isn't doing enough to stop Taliban and al-Qaeda operatives from crossing the border and taking refuge in Pakistan. Both countries are considered allies in the U.S. war on terror, but as they publicly trade accusations, it's rarely mentioned that former Taliban and other warlords are serving in Afghanistan's parliament. We're joined in studio by Afghan Member of Parliament Malalai Joya. History was made just a few months ago when Afghanistan held its first session of parliament in 30 years, and I imagine that when the people's history is written, your name will appear on those pages. You took a stand and began to denounce the presence of warlords serving in the parliament. Can you talk about who these people are serving in the Afghan parliament?
We have different kind of warlords in our country, especially in the parliaments. And they are those people that they did their test from 1992 till 1996 in our country. All of these criminals, they now they have, unfortunately, mask of democracy. Without asking them why they did lots of crimes, once again, as the delegates, they found way in the parliaments. And, of course, how they found way in the parliaments in this important place, by using foreign supports, they had foreign supports, and by using lots of money, millions of dollars they received during the war under the name of innocent people, especially orphans and the widows and poor people in of Afghanistan. And also they have lots of gun, they have power, and they did lots of cheatings in during the election period.
Let's talk about those orphans and those widows. What type of war crimes are you referring to?
During the war period, of course, they killed lots of innocent people, especially Narda Alliance. Now, most of them, they are in power in the cabinet of Afghanistan, some of them, and some of them, they are in the parliament, and they killed lots of innocent people. For example, only in Kabul, they killed 65,000 people in Kabul, and they are now our people telling them criminals, and they should go to the National International Justice Fest and teleport justice to our people that why they did these crimes.
You've had death threats made against you after speaking out. You've survived 4 assassination attempts. How has your life and your personal safety been affected since you've criticized the warlords?
Of course, that every day I receive lots of threats to this. Even I had some interview here in U.S. Last day, yesterday, through phone during interview. But also, I receive lots of support of my people, and it gives me more energy and more hopes. But on another hand, those people that they are threatening me to death, for example, even in Canada, they threat me to death. In Kabul, those enemies, especially that they are in power and parliaments, they become aware that I had trip and I exposed them. They said that warning me that when she returned, we will know what we will do with her and like this. Several times I said I will never afraid from this kind of threats and deaths that you are doing, because I believe in democracy. I believe to freedom and woman rights in my country, and I'm a freedom loving woman, and because I'm young, till I have energy, I will try to serve my people. And on another hand, I try to expose the enemies of Afghanistan, those people that they have mask of democracy and they just want to be in power right now.
Malalai Joya is a member of the Afghan parliament currently in the U.S. on a speaking tour. Join us tomorrow for part 2 of this interview. According to Guantanamo Bay hearing transcripts released by the Pentagon late Friday, hundreds of detainees continue to wait in anguish without knowledge of why they're being held as prisoners and what future lies ahead after years of confinement. Yan Mei Shea has more from Washington, D.C.
Ahmed Abdul Azizi has been detained at Guantanamo Bay for more than 3 years. He said he has been interrogated 50 times without being charged with any crime. He fears freedom will never come and told his lawyer, "We are in a grave here." Many other cases documented in the transcripts echo the same frustration and despair. Roughly 500 prisoners are held as suspected terrorists at the U.S. naval base in eastern Cuba. Charges have been filed against only 10 of them. A Guantanamo Bay prison spokesman, Army Major Jeffrey Ware, says all the inmates have valid security or intelligence reasons to be there. but Abdur Sayyad Rahman certainly disagree. He identified himself as a poor chicken farmer from Pakistan, who was taken from home by police in 2001. It turned out during a hearing that he was wrongly arrested as a Taliban official who has a similar name. Rahman said he was told by an American that he'd be freed in a couple of days. But after waiting anxiously in vain, he bemoaned, "I never saw that American again, and I'm still here." The 5,000-page transcript of hearings were released after a successful Freedom of Information Act lawsuit by the Associated Press. Jamana Musa, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Domestic Human Rights and International Justice, says the release of the document is at least a step forward, breaking the seal of secrecy at the prison.
At the very least, it's an opportunity to get a glance into who's in Guantanamo, who these people are.
A Defense Department spokesman, Major Paul Svierskos, says holding detainees in Guantanamo keeps enemy combatants from fighting against the U.S. and its allies. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
Although Ciudad Juarez has become infamous for the brutal murders of young women, the region isn't the only place in Mexico where crimes against women go routinely unpunished. According to official statistics from the Mexican federal government, Oaxaca has become a hotspot for gender-based violence. Vladimir Flores reports.
Human rights attorney Jessica Sanchez Maya is part of a women's organization that has been documenting crimes of violence against women in Oaxaca. She says that last year there were 33 documented cases of murdered women and girls. 3 months into 2006, there are already 10 cases. The attorney comments that the documentation process is complicated given that these crime figures are not public.
Unfortunately, the only way we as organizations have of following this is through newspaper reports. All of the data that we provide comes from what appears in the crime section of the newspaper.
Although Oaxacan Governor Ulises Ruiz signed an agreement last year with the federal government's special commission to investigate the murders of women, his administration does not keep separate homicide statistics for women. Local journalist Silvia Chabela Riva has been covering women's issues for years for the Noticias newspaper.
En mi caso como reportera,
as a reporter, information has been very difficult to obtain because I say that all of the government offices are totally closed to these subjects.
The lack of documentation is only one aspect of the phenomenon of gender-based violence here. One recent case illustrates why women's groups are calling for reform to what they say are outdated and discriminatory laws. In 2004, Heriberto Vázquez was given a 2-year sentence after he confessed to beating his wife to death. Vázquez was able to avoid a regular homicide charge by saying that he killed his wife because she was adulterous. He was then charged with and convicted of an honor killing, which carries a much lighter sentence. Vázquez was later freed under a program to release indigenous prisoners awaiting trial or convicted of petty crimes. He now holds a position in his town's government. The state government has also been criticized for insensitivity towards women who report domestic abuse or other acts of aggression. Such is the case of this woman who went to the state to report domestic abuse by her ex-husband.
Where I went to file my complaint that this person was beating me and abusing me, they told me, "Ms., show me where he hit you. In order for us to see the domestic violence that you say is happening, you have to come with bruises or blood so that we can see." So one just leaves. I left upset because where's the support for women that they say they can give?
A team of representatives from civil organizations today presented a detailed report to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on the situation of violence against women in Oaxaca with the hope that the commission will make some binding recommendations that will force the state's authorities to take concrete steps to improve the current situation. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech, Radio News.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
Upcoming national elections in Italy next month are just too close to call, although Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's government might be enjoying its last 2 months of power. Berlusconi's administration is still pushing hard against environmental law and engineering constraints to build the longest bridge of its kind in the world connecting Sicily to the south of Italy. But opposition from both sides of the coastline is growing. From Sicily, Naomi Fowler reports.
Sicily and the south of Italy have always been isolated politically, economically, and historically from the wealthier north. The ferries that cross the Straits of Messina are old and slow, but Sicilians here today believe building a 3,360-metre-long bridge is not the best way forward.
The cost of the bridge is about 10 billion of euro, and 10 billion of euro is a lot of money. So this is a big cake to share. So there's a political will to do this. They don't care about the people. Berlusconi is the major businessman of Italy. So he has a lot of friends.
For an estimated 10% of the cost of building the bridge, many Sicilians prefer to modernize the ferry services. As it is, the crossing from Italy to Sicily only takes about 20 minutes. There are many other logistical problems too for the bridge. Environmental campaigner Anna Giordano.
This area, it has been identified as important bird area for the European community. And now, all the Strait of Messina, including the sea, is protected by the European law. And if I was not discovering this, we didn't know, because the regional government published the law without the map.
The Messina Straits is also in a seismic zone. The Italian government admits engineers have not yet come up with a structure that can withstand tremors and quakes. High winds also mean the bridge would be closed anyway for 3 months a year.
I think that before to offer something that is not necessary, you must give to the people what is necessary. To have the water in all the houses, to have a better highway than actually what we have not only in Calabria but also in Sicily is absolutely out of a normal civil country. This we need. To have really public transportation, to use the public service by train. It takes 8 hours to go for 330 kilometers.
A structure like a bridge is the upteenth work that comes from elsewhere that is somehow thrown, and Sicilians and Calabrians should accept it, but is something like coming from Mars.
And it's not the first time Sicilians have failed to benefit from investment from the north. Anti-bridge campaigner Santi Silito.
In Sicily there are many refineries, in Gela, in Syracuse, in Milazzo, etc. And no money to Sicily, but lots of pollution. But Sicilians for a while believed that this was the industrial revolution that could benefit them, actually created only pollution. They need to have places where to wash the money, and the bridge would be the perfect chance for them, the perfect opportunity.
The 20,000 Sicilians demonstrating here today believe this project will benefit few at the cost of many. They say the money would be better spent addressing chronic underinvestment in their social services and infrastructure here. If Prodi and his left-wing party wins the Italian elections in April, the bridge project will be no more. This is Naomi Fowler in Messina for Free Speech Radio News.
South Dakota's Governor Mike Rounds has signed a bill to ban nearly all abortions in the state, directly challenging the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized the procedure in all states in 1973. Meanwhile, citizens in Mississippi have begun collecting signatures for a ballot initiative which, if approved, would also outlaw abortion in all cases unless the life of the mother or fetus was in danger. The group behind the proposal believes that if passed, it will be challenged in court, but is hopeful that with two new Supreme Court justices, a challenge to the law would fall in their favor, which could lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision which gave women the right to choose to terminate their pregnancy. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports from Jackson, Mississippi, home to the only abortion clinic still open in the entire state.
You know, most women come here and get their babies killed at between 8 and 12 weeks. And they're told inside just to ease their conscience. It's not a baby. It's just a tissue. But it's already developing. It's fully developed at this stage.
Matthew is standing outside the gates of the Jackson Women's Health Organization on North State Street. He takes turns with other people handing out pamphlets with pictures of fetuses at various stages of development. Some of the brochures also allude to links between having an abortion and getting AIDS or breast cancer. Matthew's not yet involved with gathering some of the more than 107,000 signatures which will be needed to get what's been titled the Human Life Amendment on the Mississippi ballot in November of 2007, but he's confident it will get the signatures and be passed by the voters.
We have a law on the books now that says that we can take the life of a human being because it's an inconvenience to us. It's wrong. And so any law that we can work to change, we want to do that.
Inside the clinic, half a dozen African-American women sit in the waiting room in silence, some with hoods pulled over their heads. This is the only clinic left in the state of Mississippi which performs abortions. Six others have been closed over the years in the face of death threats to doctors and constant protests. A staff member estimates that 65 women a week, some from neighboring states, come in for the legally required ultrasound, counseling on alternatives, and education on potential health risks, which must include a mention of breast cancer. After the state mandated 24-hour waiting period, 80% to 90% of the women go through with the procedure. The two visits to the clinic also provide opportunity for anti-abortion activists on the sidewalk outside to speak to women like Brittany, who came from 2 hours away with her cousin Jeremy, in an effort to make them reconsider.
And she's at work right now. I can call her. You can follow me over to her office and get a free ultrasound.
I was not even expecting this for anybody to be waiting here to hand off a pamphlet to me. I'm not going to do this. Hell
now. God is working in your heart right now because you are soft. Your heart, I mean, you may think you're hard.
This is a wake-up call for anybody.
According to the clinic's website, Mississippi has the highest teen birth rate in the country and one of the highest infant mortality rates. 60% to 70% of the women who visit the clinic are African American.
No, I was going in to get the ultrasound and everything done. I'm paying $100 for all these. But I can keep my money in my pocket. You see what I'm saying?
Keep your money to save up so you can get your own place. That's why when you do have your kid be able to say he got a home. Cause me, you know how I've been. I've been moving here since I was little. I ain't never had no place to really call home.
Yeah. Only thing I'm worried about is my child coming out with some kind of physical problems. Cause I've been smoking, I've been drinking, and now I gotta deal with that. But that's my fault.
Yeah.
Because I knew.
The Ultimate Coalition for Unborn Children, the group leading the petition drive, believes that the ballot language, which would forbid taking the life of a person, and then defines person to include all stages of biological development from conception until natural death, would lay the groundwork for an overturn of Roe v. Wade. The campaign website features clips from the Supreme Court arguments in Roe v. Wade. All of the sound bites, like this exchange between Justice Potter Stewart and Sarah Weddington, the attorney for Roe, seek to illustrate that if the fetus is determined a person, abortion would then be unconstitutional.
If it were established that an unborn fetus is a person within the protection of the 14th Amendment, you would have almost an impossible case here, would you?
I would have a very difficult case.
Certainly would.
The Ultimate Coalition for Unborn Children did not respond to requests for an interview, but David Rogers, the group's leader, told the AP he believes the replacement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor with Samuel Alito improves the Human Life Amendment's chances of withstanding a Supreme Court challenge. For FSRN, reporting from Jackson, Mississippi, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.